recording, as I said, is on the book of Genesis, the first chapter. Last year at this time, we did something from kind of the middle-ish, beginning-ish portion. This time, we're going towards the end. We're going to be stuck on one verse, and it is the final verse in the first chapter, as the Septuagint and the King James decided to paginate. I don't know if you guys know this, but the numbers of the chapters in the Bible do not exist in the what's called Masoretic tradition. The Jews of old, going back to even the between the 4th and the 12th century, had no numbers of, you know, they didn't know, quote unquote, chapter and verse, didn't exist for them. Somewhere in the medieval period, it starts to get added by the Christians. The Jews kind of resist it. They continue to refer to things by Torah portion. In fact, even into the 1800s, some rabbis wouldn't list it. But in the last, like, 200 years, Jews have come around to the fact that, you know, just explaining it's somewhere in this Torah portion is not good enough. Somehow, to some degree, the chapters do correspond to kind of a Jewish understanding of things, but not always. There are chapters of the Torah where the numbers, the chapter will end in the middle of a Torah portion, and the next Torah portion will pick up in the middle of that chapter. So it's a bit messy. We're going to be looking at verses at the end of the first of the two tellings of the creation story. What do I mean by that? The Jewish tradition overwhelmingly believes, depending on who you ask, that there are two-ish creation stories, which are either one and the same or are not one and the same. They're two completely different retellings that get stuffed into the book because we didn't want to delete either version, right? If you don't understand how that could possibly be, go back and watch any of the Marvel superhero movies of the last 25 years, and then go back and read the comic books, which may or may not correspond with each other, right? In fact, the latest, my favorite is the latest Spider-Man movie, which was an animated Spider-Man movie, is a telling of the Spider-Man story where Spider-Man is black. And it's not a problem for Peter Parker versus, I forget Miles's last name, but like, it's just basically a retelling of the same story. That's what the many rabbis and scholars would say about our creation story. The first creation story is the one we're going to be looking at. That's the standard God made the world in 7 days, right? With this thing on this day and this thing on this day and this thing on this day. The second retelling is Genesis 2, where basically God makes a bunch of stuff and then makes Adam and Eve, right? Adam and Eve don't exist in the first story at all. God makes humankind, a man and a woman. The woman's name is not mentioned. It's Zachar Onekeva Bara Otam. Male and female, God created them. And then that's it, right? In fact, the first biblical telling of the creation of humankind doesn't even bother to give the man a name. By the way, in the second biblical retelling, his name is Adam, which is the modern Hebrew word for man, right? So God made man and called him man. So if you're not happy with what your parents called you, imagine what it would be like if your name was Adam. Eve actually even has a real legitimate name. But anyways, that's beside the point. We're actually looking at the end of the creation of human beings. Last year, we spent a lot of time looking at the line that says, God created man in the divine image, right? The Saba of Slobodko, the altar of Slobodko, does an amazing teaching on that, which is from last year. This year, we're really interested in one specific section, which is super weird or really interesting or really neat, depending on who you ask. And it's that on the sixth day, God looked at all that God had made and said, behold, it is very good. All right, with that, I'm going to share the screen, which I think is, where'd the button go? There it is. Okay, sorry. It's like we started a new class in a new year, and I don't remember how Zoom works suddenly. I'm going to zoom it. Don't worry, I'm going to make it larger. There we go. Hopefully you can all see that. I'll drop this thing so that it gets a little bit larger. Excellent. All right. So we are looking at Genesis 1, verse 31. It's the last line in the first chapter. Vayar Elohim et kol asher asa v'hine tov me'od. When I was a kid growing up at summer camp, there was a song in major key, definitely written in the 70s or 80s by some folk Jewish guitarist, that went Vayar Elohim et kol asher asa v'hine tov me'od. There was... Forget it. Okay, anyways. Never come to this class expecting good singing, because you guys have a rabbi who's actually a cantor. Lovely voice. My voice isn't terrible, but it ain't good neither. All right. V'hine tov me'od. V'hier v'ivoker yom ha-shishi. And God saw all that God had made and found it very good. So we're going to come back to that. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. A couple basic notes. Most of you all know this stuff. Basic note number one, there was evening, there was morning the sixth day. That's very interesting because all of the Hebrew days in chapter one start with evening and then morning, which is why in Judaism we all start the day with the evening, and why Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah starts at night and begins in the day. The first part of a Jewish day is sundown. Fascinating, right? The second interesting thing here is all the other days of the week get mentioned as Yom Rishon, Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi, or so on. And then this day, the sixth day, is given the definite article, the Hashishi, Yom Hashishi. And grammatically, that doesn't necessarily make sense, except to say that it may be a kind of a definite noun. But it differs from the previous 5 days. So there's some interesting midrash there that gets into the question of, like, why is the letter ha there? And why are human beings potentially related to that fact that there is a definite article for the sixth day, but there's no definite article for the other days? The last thing, which is a bunch of questions that I'm not going to answer, leave you wondering till next year. The interesting point here is this phrase here, that all the other days of the week are tov, they are good. God made light. God created, separated the light from the dark, and behold, it was good. It was tov. And here we get v'hine tov me'od, right? It's very good. So that's what we call in the rabbinic world a phrase that says darsheni, right? Which is, please explain me. The rabbis are excited about this strange choice of language, which seems to be different than all the other choices of language. So we have a bunch of texts. It's entirely possible we won't get to all of them before Jeremy kicks us off, and that's all good. So our first text is by our interesting guy, which I'll tell you about first. So our speaker's name is Hillel Zeitland. Hillel Zeitland is not a chassid. In fact, he was a journalist who wrote for a magazine called Der Moment, which becomes the kind of progenitor to the modern magazine, which has been around in America for 35 years or so, called Moment Magazine, kind of the OG of big Jewish American magazines. And hasn't as much found its footing, I think, in the digital world, but they're still around. And he is referred to, so Zeitlin was a contemporary of, although he lived in a different country then, Martin Buber. And the two of them are believed to be the fathers of what is referred to as, if you like big academic fancy statements, philosophical neo-Hasidism. And that sounds like a lot of words, but one of the important things to know about Hillel Zeitlin is his work was read extensively by a guy by the name of Zalman Schachter. And Zalman Schachter adds the next name, Zalman Schachter Shalomi, it was a Chabad Chassid who kind of dropped out and tuned in to the 60s, and then becomes the founder of what is referred to as the Jewish Renewal Movement. Zalman Schachter is one of the greats of the 20th and 21st century. He passed away, I think, 4 or 5 years ago in Boulder, Colorado. I lived in Colorado for four of the years that he was there, and unfortunately never had a chance to meet the man. Ships passing in the dark. Hillel Zeitlin came to observant Judaism in the 1930s after kind of becoming a secular scholar and a secular writer. And he became deeply immersed in the Zohar, in the mystical literature that is the basis for Hasidut. He also saw the rise of Hitler as a central and traumatic moment. He saw the pogroms that were going on in Poland as prescient of a massive disaster. He believed that a small group of deeply devout individuals praying and studying Kabbalah could, I don't know, avert whatever happened. And when his kind of little group, which he called Yavne, that he founded kind of fell apart, he started to write these kind of what were referred to as prophecies of doom. I got this from an academic article you can find online that was written by Art Green, who's one of the great scholars of Hasidism today and one of the great translators of Hasidic works. Art Green is in this philosophical neo-Hasidic lineage. He would say that Zeitlin is his kind of grandfather. And I think that if you forget everything I just said, his end is the most kind of dramatic of his entire life. According to the literature, Hillel Zeitlin was incarcerated in the Warsaw Ghetto. His wife was deported to a death camp and killed. His son was killed in the ghetto. And when they came to get him, to deport him, he refused to move. He put on his talis and tefillin and clutched a book of the Zohar, which he had been working at translating into Hebrew, and was shot to death by the Nazis. Which is, wow, a dramatic end, right? A dramatic individual who lived kind of like 15 years saying things are going badly, right? I give you all this introduction because what he says here is, it makes it all the more dramatic what he says here. Some of you have probably already read it. So he's commenting on the verse that's talking about very good, right? And he did this. He would have written this commentary towards the end of his life because he didn't write any religious texts until after 1936. So pretty remarkable. He says, this is really, once you hear the life story, the first line hits you that much harder. How can one describe the entire world as very good? Are there not at least a few sorrows and defects in the world? Right? A few, he says, hama'at, a few. He says, rather, it ought to be interpreted thusly. And God saw all that God had made. In the sight of the Kadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be God, who sees all things that God have been made for good. So Tanya had a really interesting kind of riff at our opening about like good and the notion of good being like, you know, in the eye of the beholder, that if we look to the good and we will be able to see the world as good, right? Hillel Zeitlin flips the script a little bit and moves it backwards, which is to say, and I think it could be positive, but you could read it as negative, which is to say, in the sight of God, all is good, or at least all has been made for good, na'asim tovim. So there are two ways, I think, of understanding that. One way of saying this is that we should adopt the divine perspective as Jews as much as we possibly can, which is to say, good is in the eye of the beholder, and we as Jews aspire to be more like God. Therefore, we should aspire to see the world through the eyes of God, in which the world is good. Okay? That's one interesting way of reading this. Another way of reading it is a different way, which I think is Marilyn's way of reading it, based on her comments, which is to say, we should see that the world that God created is good. It's humans that do the mucky things in the universe, right? That God creates a world of wheat and flax, according to the Midrash that I told at the beginning of class. And we as humans can either do nothing with it, like the first son, or we can do something with it and make of that world something great. Or we can take the mucky things that happen in the world and accept them as terrible, or we can do something with them. Right? We should, if you see something unjust, it is an opportunity to protest. If you see someone that is doing a bad thing, it is an opportunity to move them into the category of doing a good thing. So that's, I think, a two ways of reading Hillel's Island that I think are relevant. I want to add one more thing, which is there are only a few times in this book, which is one of the reasons I like this book, that the author, Rabbi Greenberg, will choose to pick a not famous rabbi or someone who's not even really in the general canon of religious Jews, right? This guy, Hillel Zeitlin, kind of falls inside and kind of falls outside of the Hasidic world. Moses Mendelssohn and one or two other famous individuals show up in this book occasionally, and their statements that are included in this work are all the more remarkable in that a chassid, a truly, you know, black hat from Yid, would not accept these teachings as religious teachings. This guy is, because he's from within the secular school, but, you know, his teaching is religious enough that it falls in the book. All right. This one's a weird one. You may not like this one, but I was translating it. I finished it. I'm like, I don't know if I like this, but I'm going to include it for class anyways. I think that's a good thing to give you guys occasionally the opportunity to say, this is a good thing. Good. Tov. This is the Malach HaChaim, a phrase I've never heard before, the angel of life. Very me'od. This is the Malach HaMavet, the angel of death. And that's from this book that I held up before, Midrash Breishit Rabbah. So the Midrash, which was composed somewhere between the 1st century before the Common Era and the 4th century of the Common Era, has this thing that basically says Tov is actual good. Tov Me'od is a weird reference to what we would call the Malach HaMavet, death. Right? So life and death. Tov is life. Tov Me'od is death. Very strange. Okay. This Rabbi Yaakov Simchoni is going to try and break this down. If one takes from everything that which is truly necessary, behold, this is good. This is life. Very. If one receives a heaping portion and pursues all things permitted, this is the angel of death, which brings one down to Sheol. Sheol is a very old school, original version of like hell, basically. But it was kind of in the early Torah period, it seems like a shadowy netherworld of where your soul goes, whether you're good or bad. Later on, the rabbis kind of reinterpret Sheol to be a bad place. Okay, so what is this text? I think this is the anti-Gordon Gekko, right? Gordon Gekko in the famous movie from the 80s, greed is good. Judaism says having what you need is good. Greed is evil and actually leads you to the bad place, right? The person who pursues material things, who pursues more than they need, right, is going to put themselves in a place where they go to a bad place. I don't know. It's an okay text. I think the next text is a riff on that because it's based on the same Midrash, and it pulls it out a little bit more. This one also, I wasn't sure I loved, but there's one word in it that I really loved, and so it kind of helps with our understanding. So this is from the Maggid of Dubno. The Maggid of Dubno would have been a contemporary with and a student of the Baal Shem Tov himself. Yaakov Simchoni is a fairly obscure rabbi that I could find very, very little about. So I don't know who he is. So the Maggid of Dubno said this, very good, this is death. So it's a slight change on the words we had before, which sometimes happens either in Hasidut or Midrash, where they learned something orally and they reprinted it as they remembered it, and they may have dropped a word. So in the original text, it's the angel of death, and in this retelling, it's death itself, for whatever it's worth. If one sees for themselves something that is very good in something that is extravagant and excessive, which attracts your heart too much, this experience one must be very cautious with. So this opening here is very much in the kind of idea of the seven deadly sins, right? A person who lives a fairly straightforward and simple life, this is laudable. This is a good way of living. The person who kind of they get that $500 bottle of wine and they have a drink of it and they go, ooh, I like this. How do I get more of this, right? The person who has that finely aged Kobe beef that is just absolutely the perfect steak that costs $900 an ounce and eats it and says, oh my God, I need more of this. The person who sits in a Ferrari and goes for a drive one time and goes, wow, this is the true driving experience, right? Like kind of the person who follows any of the other deadly sins, right? And says, this is the pinnacle. Like I, my eyes are now open. And then they pursue that. They pursue luxury. They pursue only the best, only the finest, only the greatest. And I'm not talking like, you know, excellence in terms of learning or excellence in terms of expecting, you know, to be around the great individuals. Clearly, this is about material wealth, because the word here that's used is extravagance and excess, right? And the Hebrew word that he uses, the Maggid of Dubno uses, is mugzam, which I'm going to reference in a second. You've got to be, and he doesn't say don't do it. He doesn't say like you cannot drink the $900 glass of bottle of wine. He says this experience one must be very cautious with. And then he goes on and he says something very strange, which we may agree with and we may not. He says, he quotes the Talmud, you should remove your hand, i.e. stop eating, from a meal that you enjoy. Okay, so I didn't bring that text, but the further text is hysterical. It's a quote from Rabbi Chiya in the Talmud. I put it on my Twitter if you want to go look it up later. If I go diving for it now, we'll lose it. The opening line basically says, Rabbi Chiya said, a person who experiences indigestion very often should dip their wine, their food during the winter and the summer in vinegar or wine, because it will make the food go down better. Then it says, you should remove your hand from a meal that you enjoy. And then our text stops quoting. There's a comma there in the Talmud, and the Talmud goes on, for one that eats excessively will come to indigestion. Okay? The next line is even more funny, which is, one must take care that when one needs to use the restroom, one should get up and use the restroom immediately, right? So the opening, so this is a brilliant text because our rabbi only quotes, you should stop eating a meal that you enjoy too much. But the opening text is, here's how not to get indigestion. And the end text is, remember to poop, okay? Go remember to poop. It's important to poop, okay? If you feel the need to poop, get up and go poop. And that's, by the way, this is not Rabbi Goodman being inappropriate. That's in the Talmud. Okay. By the way, the Talmud, I have studied much Talmud, not as much as some of my colleagues, but the Talmud is full of advice about indigestion. The rabbis often talking about how to have a good bowel movement. It's a very important topic in the Talmud. They have lots of advice about what to eat, when to pray, when not to pray, when not to eat, when to fast, different seasons, right? Like, so much you will come to, I mean, I've learned from a dozen different tractates, maybe a couple hundred pages of Talmud, and they come to indigestion and pooping way more often than you would think. It's very strange. Okay. Anyhow, let's finish the text because it gets weirder. I give you a Talmud text that has pooping in it, and then we move on to a text that continues with even weirdness. It continues, the Maggid of Dubno goes back and says, only meat that is not so fresh is seasoned in various spices to remedy the bad taste and smell. Good meat that is fresh has no need for spices. So we could read that literally, right? Which is that in the Maggid of Dubno's time, they probably did have some problems with getting fresh meat. And therefore, he was suspicious and he was telling his followers, be suspicious if you've got really spicy, you know, if you've got someone who's like, you know, adding all sorts of spices to the meat, they may be covering up the fact that it's been rotten for a couple days, right? But we can also read that, of course, homiletically and try and understand this, which is he's saying in a very interesting way that adding more, right, spicing your meat excessively might be covering up something that's not pure, right? If meat's really good, you don't put salt or pepper or paprika or anything on it. You just grill it and you eat it, right? And this is a parable that he's using for life. Life in the raw, life in its original context, life at its freshest, doesn't need bells and whistles. It doesn't need more, right? Why do I need a Ferrari when I have the best bicycle in the world, right? Why do I need to go up to the Himalayas to view the mountains when I can drive, you know, to a snow-capped peak here in West, nearby in West Virginia and be blown away? Why do I need to spend an extravagant vacation in upstate New York to go leafing, to be a leaf peeper, when I can look out my window and see one beautiful tree with red and yellow leaves, right? Appreciate what is present in the world right now. Appreciate the food that is in front of you. Appreciate the family that you have. Appreciate the good, because the very good is extravagance, and it is finely spiced meat, which might be covering up something that is highly unnecessary, right? It's a very interesting perspective on the world. Appreciate what you have. Very good in this context is bad. Good is good enough. It's a really interesting riff, right? Okay, I'm gonna stop sharing and let anybody kind of break in if you have any kind of thoughts on these texts. We have two more texts to go if you're interested, but I think this is a really interesting one. Rich, did you want to say something since you're unmuted?
Thank you. I think this rabbi is maybe overdoing it, that he doesn't trust people to go for the better than good, that they'll go too far. And that's okay. It's, you know, nothing wrong with that, I suppose. I just, I don't know if it's necessary, but that's what seems to be what's happening here, almost treating us like children in some ways.
I agree. And I think for a lot of, this is a very Hasidic text in the sense that we have reviewed a lot of texts which deal with humility and kind of penury and the kind of moral value of being humble and of low state, right? Judaism kind of runs in both directions. There's a principle within Judaism called Chidur Mitzvah in which it is nice to have an etrog, but it's really nice to put your etrog in a silver box. It is nice to have a small, simple shofar. It is really nice to spend money on a more fancy shofar. And Sukkot is another one of those, right? You can build a sukkah out of, you know, rickety branches you find in the neighborhood. But if you build a big, luxurious, lovely sukkah that all of your neighbors can come eat in, all the better. So the principle of elevating and beautifying and making things glorious is not one that should be eschewed as long as one is doing it for the right reasons, right? I would even go so far as to say, right, like if I were Sergey Brin or I'm trying to think of billionaires, don't really have any of Mark Zuckerberg. Thank you. Right. If I were a billionaire, it might be okay for me to drive a Ferrari or to live in a big house as long as I was giving a lot of my money to other purposes. But, you know, the person who says, you know, I need it. The Sultan of Brunei, you should look this up. The Sultan of Brunei once had so many cars that they didn't fit inside his indoor garage. And so he started to park them outdoors. And the Sultan of Brunei had more cars than anyone in the world. And many of them were famous, no other existing versions of it, like, you know, 1934 Bugattis that literally rotted in the jungle because he couldn't cover them. So maybe the Sultan of Brunei, not so much, right? Okay.
How do I raise my hand?
Judith, you're doing it right now. Go ahead.
No, yeah, I know, but is that how you do it? Because on some programs, there's actually an icon for raising your hand.
There should be if you go into your participant stream. Unfortunately,
I think
so. Yeah, unfortunately, because I'm the host, it looks different for me. So,
okay. So I'm sorry.
Okay.
All right. I'm raising my hand.
Okay, go. You don't have to. You can just talk, Judith.
I thank you for this brilliant teaching. I think it's amazing. I think the idea of greed is frequently exhibited and is a part of people's personalities who feel empty inside. So greed means nothing is ever enough. And that leads to the death of the soul. And I'm blown away by this obscure rabbi that I certainly have never heard of. And I went to rabbinical school. But at this point, I've forgotten more than I remember. But I think it's a brilliant, brilliant way of interpreting. And I was wondering if other people were also struck by it. You were obviously struck by it because you included it. But I think it's amazing.
Thank you. All right. Marilyn wanted to...
The question of having a glass of $500 bottle of wine, that's not the problem. The problem is that you have to have it all the time, and after you have it, then you want the $700 bottle.
Right.
And nothing, everything ends up being ashes in your mouth, metaphorically speaking.
Yeah, I think I
think it's a great segue to a great sermon.
I think it's also a great text because it doesn't say don't do this. The text before that kind of implies that. It says be very cautious. And I think that's kind of amazing that it says, like, you can have exactly what you said. You can have a $900 glass of wine. You just can't have two, you know, or three, or start, you know, obsessing and becoming extremely focused on only the finest, right? Enjoy a chili dog once in a while. All right, Marilyn, go ahead.
I just want to, ask you, because you put a qualifier in your explanation that isn't anywhere in what he wrote. And that is, let's take a different example. What if your garden, if you just leave it as nature left it and it's spoiling, you shouldn't fix it? You shouldn't go out there and weed? You shouldn't go out there and do more to make it more beautiful? So when you said it depends on the intent, I agree with you. But the way he's phrased it, it seems to be suggesting an absolute that leaves out certain opportunities to beautify, to make things better, to make them grow. And I think that your version, which I don't see in his words, and you know how I am about words, is wonderful. And I agree, greed is terrible, but there's a difference between greed and aggregating things so that you can enrich something. And I think that he doesn't make that distinction, even though you did.
Nice.
That's my 2 cents worth.
It's great. On your point, I am going to share a screen again to show you just a fun thing, which for those of you who like contemporary Israeli music, I highly recommend. I will put this in the chat. So I use there's the word there, mugzam, and I put a little number by it because I put it as a footnote. So I'm going to give you guys this. You should cut and paste it onto your own screen when you get a chance. I'm going to put it in the chat. I have to stop share to do that. Don't you love how I have to talk in order to make things work? So this is a video of a very popular, this was a huge hit in Israel about 3 years ago. Don't click on it because it'll start playing immediately. But if you cut and paste it, you can save it. And this was a huge hit by a musician by the name of Ivri Lider, who's one of Israel's biggest rock stars. And it's a song called Mugzam, which literally would translate as excess or excessive. It's a very fun song. And the opening line in the song is, Im hayali kol hakesef be'olam, hayiti ben zonam mugzam, which is a swear word in Hebrew, but I'll translate it as such. If I had all the money in the world, I would be a complete and total excessive asshole. Ben zonah best translates as the son of a whore, but in Hebrew it's used kind of the way we in America use asshole. So I think this is a perfect explanation of our text, which is being a person who lives for excess and it attracts your heart too much, this experience one must become very cautious with, right? This is the Maggid of Dubno writing 250 years before Ivri Lieder came up with this song. So a really cool little riff on that that I think is worth pulling into the text if you're pulling up later if you're interested. It's a wonderful song, and there are two versions of the song. Another one is by a guy by the name of Stefan Leger. Stefan Leger, a rapper in Israel who was born to Nigerian parents, is not Jewish, is fluent in Hebrew, Arabic, French, English, and Ebe, which is a Nigerian language, and raps in all five languages. So he is Stefan Leger, highly recommended if you're looking for music. All right, I think Phil, you were up next, unless I mix that up.
Hey, did I read? I feel like the first part of the quote was he was saying something along the lines of we're talking about times of creation, and he's saying surely it couldn't have all been good, it couldn't have all been very good, right? I don't know that. As soon as I read that, I was like, "Why not? Like, we're talking about creation. What, like that? I mean, I understand you set it up by explaining who this person was and having maybe a rough outlook. But whoa, you know, that's really a rough outlook. I think to be looking at creation and the Torah saying, "Oh, it was God said it was very good," and basically disagreeing, like, "Whoa, there's got to be something. Maybe, you know, there's got to be some problems there already. I think maybe there weren't any problems yet. You know, I mean." I don't know, just that struck me. You know, all the stuff about excess for sure. I've been recently getting into cheap bourbons, and what I like to do is I like to find the ones where I'm online I can find like real whiskey snobs trying cheap bourbon blind and like saying they pay 80 or 100 bucks for it. So it's like, you know, it's like that's like my way of being like, oh, okay, that's the one I want to go get. You know, it costs $20 or whatever, $30.
That's great. I highly recommend not doing that with Southern Comfort. Southern Comfort is the worst thing I've ever drunk in my entire life. The worst. I bought it like as a regular bourbon and thought like, oh, it's, you know, it's the cheap bourbon. No, it's just.
It's a strange hybrid liquor.
It's like someone poured strawberry chocolate sugar into alcohol. It's terrible. Not chocolate. Anyways. Phil, I put the quote that you're referencing from Hillel Zeitlin into the original. I think you have a really good point, which is a Hasidic perspective, understanding the world as not all good, is automatically like interesting and questionable. I think the phrase that's key here is he uses the phrase in Hebrew, olam kulo, the entire world, and the concept that the entire world has, quote unquote, tzorot, tzuris, as we would know in Yiddish, right, sorrows, and defects, pagum, that they're like, you know, flaws to the world. And we can go back to what Marilyn said at the beginning of class and talk about human-made flaws, that like this could be the way the world is imperfect because of the things that humans do in it. We could also look at it in terms of the fact that, you know, the world is a place in the Kabbalistic understanding. The world in its creation, God poured the universe into a vessel and the vessel shattered. And that original Kabbalistic idea of what's called Shvirat HaKelim implies that creation requires brokenness, right? To quote Leonard Cohen, the amazing musician, there is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. I think that that is a Kabbalistic understanding of the world, that brokenness, imperfection is hardwired into the universe. You know, Leonard Cohen always gives me the amazing memory of the Japanese art where you take a broken pot and you glue it back together. But in the gluing back together, you use gold in the binding element so that you wind up with this broken piece of pottery that has these little strips of gold running through it, and you bring it back better. And I think that that's one way of looking at this concept of bringing back the world better, you know, addressing the world with its sorrows and its defects. Any other kind of comments, or should we do one or two more texts? There's a couple. We have 4 minutes, so I will rip through the text as fast as possible, what we've got left. I think there's something, there's at least one or two texts that we can get to. We won't get to probably the last guy, although he's a good bumper sticker text. So if I don't have time, maybe I'll throw it up on Twitter later. So this one's just kind of neat because it's a riff on the first text in terms of understanding human beings as imperfect and seeing things in the eyes of God. So this is another guy who was, by the way, there are 6 or 7 different texts referred to as the Tal Orot. I'm 80% sure that this is the right Tal Orot, a guy by the name of Rav Tuvia Yehuda Tavyomi of Sochachin, who was a disciple of Avram of Bornstein, whose son is this Shem Mishmuel, two of the Sochachov Rebbes, who we have learned a bunch of. So clearly, Rabbi Grinberg really likes the Sochachov Rebbe and all of his followers. So he said this: limited is the knowledge of humans, and their grasp is limited and minimal. They know only what they see with their eyes, and this is greatly restricted and distorted. We are fortified in what we understand and discern from the ways of the universe, the ways of God, and God's conducting of the world, and ask God and are astonished at the progression of events in the world. I think this is nice for our modern historical context, where a lot of us think like things are going badly and this is not good. However, in the eyes of God, can gaze to the farthest extent, grasping it all and comprehending it all, from the beginning of a matter to the end. May reshit ad tachlit. And this is, quote, and God saw, vayar Elohim saw, all that God had made, the reason and all surroundings, the beginning and the end, quote, and it was very good. So the neat move that this Rebbe does, the Tal Orot, whose name translates, the text translates to the dew of light, Tal Orot, is to say, it's a riff on that first text, which is from God's perspective, maybe it is very good. This perspective is different. It's that God is eternal and infinite, and therefore God sees how it all comes out. And in the long stretch of things, it'll work out, which is another way of restating potentially Dr. Martin Luther King's famous statement, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice, right? In the short term, right now in America, things look awful. But maybe this is somehow part of the larger scheme of building towards a better world, right? To be Joe's like, no. And what Joe is saying, I love what Joe is saying, just the shake of the head, because you are also referencing a Talmudic view, which is this concept in Sanhedrin 99, which says that there is a messianic era coming around the bend, but the beginning of the messianic era is what is referred to as Hevle Mashiach, the birth pangs of the Messiah, in which the world is full of really bad things, right? It's this kind of apocalyptic sense of the world that, like, we get Gan Eden, we get, you know, everything is great at the end of days, but the last, you know, kind of stretch going into that is really bad, right? Which has some sort of Christian overtones of kind of like the end of days, you know, kind of ushering in. And Sanhedrin 99 is generally regarded by the rabbis as, I don't know, man, I don't like that. But another way of looking at it without being so dramatic and apocalyptic is to say, you know, we we sometimes go through rough times in order to get into better times. That's all my time for today. Jeremy's going to kick me off in 30 seconds. So it was great seeing you all again. Thanks, you guys, and have a wonderful, blessed day. If you haven't been outside much today, go outside. It's real, at least here in Pittsburgh. It's real nice. Take a walk and you know, remember that the $12 bottle of wine is sometimes just as good as the $900.